Thank you, Gary. We do have a great God because he's in control of all of this mess, right? Have you ever thought about the fact that the more things get out of control and the fact that God is going to bring order out of chaos, so the more they're out of control, the greater glory comes to God for bringing in his kingdom. If you are leaving tonight, you know, and not returning to the conference tomorrow, make sure that you put your bag, your badge and lanyard, on the table before you leave so we can recycle next year. We're going green. I can't wait till the day when God trashes the planet during the tribulation myself, but of course he'll clean it up again without the EPA help. Our next speaker is Jimmy DeYoung, who has the ministry prophecy today, and Jimmy lives part-time in Israel and part-time in the United States, and he's going to come and talk to us about Israel and from the nation of Israel, the perspective from Israel itself. Thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Tommy. Somebody, when I was out taking the break, came up to me and said, I hope you're going to tell us some good news. Well, I do have three good news items. I'd call them praise items. Somebody that is at the back door there, just look out there. My wife is right out there, and tell her to come in here just a moment. On September the 12th this year, my wife and I celebrated 50 years of an anniversary together. Stand up, honey. Anybody's in ministry, you know that's the key component in any of your ministry. We had a marvelous time. We had the whole family in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We even had the people that were in our wedding party come to be with us at the celebration. Boy, those people have gotten old. But we had a great time. It was all going real well till some smart-aleck guy walked up to my wife and said to her, "You've been married to him for 50 years? Hello?" It was a 50th wedding anniversary. And she said, "Yes, I have." And he said, "Well, how in the world do you stay married to him for 50 years? And she looked with a great big smile right at him and said, "Oh, he's an itinerant preacher, which means he's gone half of the time." Well, that would give us 25 years together, but that's not where she quit. She then said, "And when he's home, he works a third of the time. That gives us about 18 years together. He sleeps a third of the time. That gives us about 8 years together. I send him to the store a lot. We've actually been together 2.5 years. So you can celebrate a 50th anniversary if you do it that way. That's one of the praise points that I wanted to give you. The second praise point, we are very excited about a project that Dr. John Ankerberg, who's a member of this organization, and I worked together on this last year. We have written a book. We did an accompanying video. And we have a study guide to go along with it. It's called Israel Under Fire. The book contains the conversations that we had with every major Israeli leader, including Benjamin Netanyahu. I spent time with him, and we talked about the problems, everything that everybody's been talking about in the book. The first half of the book, Israel Under Fire, would be the transcribed conversations that we had with them, the people who are in charge of Israeli intelligence. We talked with Reuven Rivlin, who is the speaker of the Knesset, similar to the position that Nancy Pelosi has, but totally different in content. And we have transcribed those. And then the last half of the book, I take the thought of Israel under fire and study through the book of Revelation as to how that unfolds. Actually, Harvest House did not like the two titles that John and I had come up with. They gave us Israel under fire. We both rejected it, but I think it's probably the greatest thing we could have done. The video that accompanies it is 2 hours plus. There's 9 sections on it, and we use the team that does all of the videoing for the Disney World operation in Orlando, Florida. The man, David Nixon, is a born-again Christian from Australia. His mother and dad are missionaries in the outback there. He did Facing the Giants. He was the one that produced that. And they took a professional team. Our son Jim, who's here with us, managed the team, and we went. They did the videography, and it is just fantastic. It's 9 different points. And then we put together a study guide. John and I wrote it. And it's a great Sunday school lesson, 9 different lessons. We give you the introductory words, the questions. We even give you the answers in the back. And so that is a tool that might be of interest to you. We have a couple of them on the table outside. And then one more blessing I want to share with you before we get to the report. And that is that Daystar Satellite Television Network came to John Ankerberg about a week and a half ago and told him, we've been on Daystar with the John Ankerberg television program. You may have seen some of the programs we've been doing together. And they have a Sunday evening showing across the United States of America. They opened up a 3:30 in the afternoon on Sunday afternoon, East Coast time, 3:30 p.m. time. It would be 2:30 Central, 1:30 on the West Coast. And then they gave us the opportunity to purchase prime time across the rest of the world. We will be seen at prime time. I've already received emails from South Africa, for example, and other locations. We'll be seen in Europe at prime time, the Middle East at prime time. We'll be seen in all of South America, the Caribbean, Australia, all of these at prime time. And it's very interesting. India has mostly cable operations. We're in 39 million cable homes in India. And the Lord has just opened up a marvelous opportunity for John and the program and for the partnership we're doing. I was very excited about the fact he called me, and when I was on the road, he was so excited he couldn't hardly stand it. By the way, he sends his greetings to you here. But John said that what he was going to do to kick off the first 5 programs, I did a series with him a couple of months back on walking through the book of Revelation. You might remember a couple of years ago, I walked through the book of Revelation, had you walk through it with me, just like a bunch of kids, and you did a very good job, by the way. But we did that, and that's the series he's running to kick it off. So we praise the Lord that the Lord is opening up unique opportunities around the world to get the message that we are preaching and thinking and studying and participating here at this particular location. Let me give a couple of add-ons as far as some of the comments that have been made. Bill was talking about the fact that the Iranian situation is very key as it relates to the Middle East. Just before I came up here, I was checking my email. Got an email from Colonel Bob McGinnis. If you've ever listened to our radio, nationwide radio broadcast, you've heard Bob McGinnis. You've probably seen him on CNN or Fox News or NBC, some of the other networks that he participates in doing analysis of what's happening in our world. He is the he is an advisor to the Defense Department, and he sent me an email that the head of Israeli intelligence for the Israeli Defense Force met in a secret briefing at the Knesset yesterday, and they let this leak out. And his question was, why did it leak out, and especially to the Pentagon? And the statements made were that Israeli intelligence believes that Iran has now the capability of making a weapon of mass destruction with the Shahab delivery system. They can deliver it to Israel. And the only reason they have not done it, they're waiting for the Ayatollah Khomeini to give them permission, the mullahs to go ahead and give them permission to do that. Netanyahu, when we had an opportunity to talk with him, told us there were 2 red lines as far as Iran is concerned. The first one would be the delivery of the S-300 ground-to-air anti-aircraft missile that could be fired by the Iranians at any F-16 coming in. And then the other red line, of course, is when they realized that there was going to be a weapon of mass destruction that they could make into a warhead and mount it on the Shahab's missiles, the long-range missiles, they would go ahead and do that. The Deputy Defense Minister made a statement within the last week that they're waiting for the Obama administration to go ahead and finish their conversations with Iran. whatever those conversations are, and that they are going to probably have to do something after Christmas, which is basically what Bill was passing along as well. So it's going to be, I think, very soon that something may happen as far as that concerns. I'm not predicting it, that it will absolutely happen. I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but it is very interesting that that's developing. David talked to us about the European Union, and I don't know if you're aware of the fact that today the foreign ministers of the 27 member states met in Brussels, Belgium, for the purpose of voting on the division of the city of Jerusalem. They did pass a resolution that Jerusalem should be the capital of two states, Israel and Palestine. Only one problem about those men who are foreign ministers of those 27 member states, I don't know where they're coming up with a state called Palestine. There never has been a state called Palestine, so I don't know how they're going to re-put that back together and bring it into a state. But that vote did take place today. It was also interesting, and David brought this out, that they passed over Tony Blair as the president, the permanent president of the European Union member states. And, of course, it is evident that President Sarkozy of France, Angela Merkel of Germany, did not want to have that type of competition on the world stage. Tony Blair, a very charismatic man. But he, I don't think, is out of the picture yet. If I study Bible prophecy correctly, in the book of Daniel, chapter 7, the ten horns appear, which would be, I believe, the revived Roman Empire. And then later, after that has been formed, and they put a very pragmatic man, the former prime minister of Brussels, Belgium, in as the now permanent president, Van Rompuy. And I believe that that is going to gel the European Union with a man who will put all the infrastructure together for that. Tony Blair is still the Middle East peace envoy for the quartet, the United States, European Union, United Nations, and Russia. And Tony Blair, this last week, was on John King's CNN Sunday program. He made some very interesting statements. I thought maybe, I hope and pray that most of you are in church and didn't see that CNN program. But maybe we could play just a portion of it, let you listen to what he had to say about his optimism for peace in the Middle East.
I'm more naturally optimistic. I see it as an opportunity. I also think both of them have got one great source of strength that's not to be underestimated here. I mean, I spend a lot of time in Israel and in the Palestinian territory. There is no doubt in my mind at all that a majority of people, both Israelis and Palestinians, want to see a two-state solution. Their doubt over the past years has been whether it's possible to have it, but their commitment in principle to getting it has not diminished. So our task, if you like, is to set the context in which they think this can be done. Now, I spend time talking to the leadership of both sides. Whatever doubts they have about each other's good faith from time to time, I mean, I don't doubt the good faith of either. I think they genuinely want to find a way through, but they come at it from completely opposite sides. Israel wants to know that its security is going to be protected. Well, on the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority have made real strides forward in security. I mean, I can go to cities on the West Bank now, Jenin and Nablus and Hebron and Qalqilia, Jericho, places that 2 years ago would have had quite a different security setting, now with security greatly improved. So there are things that the Palestinians are doing actually to help meet that Israeli concern. On the other side, for the Palestinians, what they need to know is that if they sit down and talk to the Israelis, it will lead genuinely to an independent Palestinian state. And what is it that they want to know? They want to know that the weight of occupation will be lifted. But there again, actually, there have been some things that have happened on the West Bank. Checkpoints open, some of the restrictions lifted, Israeli Arabs coming into the Palestinian territory, an increase in economic growth as a result. The West Bank economy is probably growing maybe in double digits, actually, at the moment. So there is real potential and hope. But the next month, I think, will be completely critical, fundamental to this, because if we can't get negotiations going that are credible, then the vacuum that is created will suit no one but the extremists.
Well, let me follow up on that point.
That's very interesting. It will suit nobody but the extremists and those who do not really want to have a relationship, a coexistence between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Bill brought out the fact that there was no conversation about Iran. They're reporting differently in Israel, that when Prime Minister Netanyahu was with the president, that was their main discussion. But in addition to that, the absolute pressure behind all of the Obama administration that they must stop any type of building or even purchasing properties or buildings inside what they refer to as the West Bank. It's the biblical term Judea and Samaria. We know exactly where that is, from Jerusalem north all the way up to the Sea of Galilee. And it's in that area where you have somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000, half a million Jewish settlers out there, with some 200 Jewish settlements. Benjamin Netanyahu did put in place, implemented a 10-month moratorium on any type of building, not only in the area of Judea and Samaria, but that would include Jerusalem itself. I've lived for the last 18 years in a neighborhood in Jerusalem called Gilo, and that has become a major hot point as it relates to them building some 9,000 units in Gilo. And the Palestinians, of course, are doing everything they can to try to stop that. As Bill brought out, the president went into Cairo and there spoke to the Muslim world. And it's in that position, when he was speaking there, that he put in place the plan for the Palestinians to continue to resist going back to the negotiating table, because he said at that point in time, the Jewish settlements are illegal and the Jews must be removed from that area that should be a Palestinian state. And he indicated, and so did the European Union foreign ministers today, that the Palestinian state should include Gaza, the area of Judea and Samaria, and a portion of the city of Jerusalem as its capital. And that's what they're moving on. Because Obama made this statement in Cairo to the Islamic world, the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, has become very hard line as it relates to going back to the negotiating table. I'll let you hear in just a moment what Itamar Marcus, who is the head of Palestinian Media Watch, had to say about them rejecting it. But a couple of thoughts as far as what Netanyahu did. We believe that there was pressure from the Obama administration. You might be aware of the fact that Hillary Clinton stood up and made the statement that the Jewish settlements are illegal and they must be evacuated. And others in the administration, in the State Department, the man in charge of the political activities, Deputy Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, also made the statement that these settlements must be evacuated. So you put that kind of pressure on a nation, and the Prime Minister, enduring whatever he possibly can to have a coexistence. If he is going to go to Iran, which is probably the case, he's going to need at least the backing, or not an attack from the Obama White House as they do that preemptive strike, if that's what it comes to. So that's some of the thinking in Israel. In fact, that's what Prime Minister Netanyahu is saying, and many of his Likud members are going along with that. Howbeit, I believe it was an unbelievably beautiful PR move by Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu came into the political arena under the mentoring of a man named Moshe Arons, who's probably one of the greatest statesmen in the state of Israel. Three times he served as the defense minister under different administrations. He was also the ambassador to the United Nations, the ambassador to the United States. His best friend was a man named Morty Dolinsky, a longtime friend of our families, and he was the best PR man I ever heard in the world. He said, look, we don't care what the rest of the world thinks about Israel, and we're concerned only what the Arab world thinks about us. And I think Netanyahu has put himself in a position to make the Palestinians look foolish, because they will not accept the opportunity to go to the negotiating table. Danny Dayan, who heads up the Organization of Jewish Settlement Leaders, has been outspoken in why the Jews have a right to be in that piece of real estate. When John and I were doing the television production in Jerusalem, we interviewed Danny Dayan in the city of Jerusalem. Thought you might like to hear what his thoughts are as to why the Jewish settlers should be in that part of the world. Danny, you're the chairman of Yesha, which is an organization
of the Jewish settlements throughout all of Israel. Are you having to defend the right for these Jewish people who live in these communities in what are biblically termed Judea and Samaria?
Yes, it should be so obvious that the places in which Jewish history was created, in the places in which the Jewish nationality came, that God promised to the sons of Israel, to the people of Israel, should be ours. Unfortunately, as in other parts of the world, a lot of illusions that if we give up our national rights and establish a so-called Palestinian state in the heartland of the land of Israel, then we will have peace. The fact is that it's completely opposite.
So then the Jewish settlements are strategic to the security of the state of Israel, not only to the territories.
No doubt about it. The civilian presence of 300,000 Jews living in Judea and Samaria is what makes what secure the well-being of Israel. They make possible to prevent a renewed vicious terrorist attacks on coffee shops and hotels and shopping malls in Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, Haifa, and Netanya, because our presence brings also military presence, and that military presence is that prevents, as I said, the new vicious terrorist aggressions. It's aggression against Israel. There is one of the most gross misconceptions is that the so-called settlements, the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, are an obstacle for peace. The truth is that we are an obstacle for war. We are an obstacle for renewed aggression against Israel. We are an obstacle for an Islamic fundamentalistic state that will destabilize the whole Middle East.
An obstacle for war is what these Jewish settlers are. And Danny Dayan came out of a meeting about 48 hours ago with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and they had an emergency meeting of all the leadership in the Jewish settlements, and they said they're going to use every bit of force they possibly can to bring down this implementation of this moratorium. They've already started using some of the young Jewish teenage girls to stand at the entrance of these Jewish settlements, and the Israeli government inspectors trying to come in, they've stopped them. They're going to do everything they possibly can. They are not going to allow this to happen. He said it's the principle. It's not the point that it may be a way to get the United States to back Israel's preemptive attack on Iran. It's the principle that a Jew has a right to live in any piece of real estate that God has given them, and they believe that God has given them this state of Israel as their land, the Jewish land in the last days. This was the fact that they implemented this moratorium was presented to the Palestinians. Itamar Marcus, who heads up the Palestinian Media Watch, and you ought to try to get on his website and stay in tune with it. It's PALWATCH, PALWATCH.org. And he keeps you informed as to what the media is really saying. He's had opportunity to address the United States, the committees in the United States Congress, the European Union, etc. He has always been called upon by Israeli leaders. But here's what he had to say about the reaction by the Palestinians.
They've already rejected it, they said, because building is still going on in Jerusalem, because 3,000 houses that are already being built can continue being built. I mean, it would be impossible for any government to stop houses in the middle that have already been approved, that people have already invested tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars in, and yet the Palestinian Authority has used that as an excuse for not coming back to the negotiation table. So no sooner had the announcement been said than the Palestinians rejected it.
Again, I must remind you, the Obama administration put the Palestinians in the position where they could take this very much of a hard line. David Wilder is the spokesperson at the oldest Jewish community in the history of the world, dating back 4,000 years ago. Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees, up over the Fertile Crescent, down in, passing through Bethel, and came to a place called Hebron. And now there are a number of Jews that live there, 750 of them, surrounded by 125,000 Palestinian terrorists. And John and I were there, and while we were there, it was so noticeable that the Israeli Defense Force, it has such a presence in Hebron, it's unbelievable. But I talked to him, asking him if indeed the Palestinians got their state, would they have to move out? Some interesting thoughts he has.
No other people in the world that have ever done what the Jewish people have done here. We came back, we brought a land that was dead back to life. There was no greenery here. Everything was barren. It was hostile. There was nothing here. And we brought it back to life. So now we have a problem. We have to overcome that problem. We're 60 years old, but 60 years old in the history of the world, it's a very small period of time.
What would happen if indeed the Palestinians were victorious, they got this piece of real estate as their state? Would you, as a Jewish community, stay here and continue to live here?
I don't see anybody picking up and leaving. Okay, this is our home. First of all, I don't think it's going to happen. Okay, God did not bring us back here to throw us out again. He didn't bring us back to the land of Israel after 2,000 years of exile to throw us out again. And he didn't bring us back to our roots, to a place like Tel Hebron, which is property that we've owned legally since the beginning of the 1800s, but we've owned in reality since 4,000 years ago. He didn't bring us back here to say, okay, guys, take off. So I don't think that's going to happen. But nobody here has any plans on leaving. This is our home, and this is where we're planning on staying.
This is our home, and we're here to stay. Amen. They are going to be there throughout eternity future, those who receive Jesus Christ as their Messiah. Well, we've talked a little bit about the situation as far as peace in the Middle East is concerned, the part that Tony Blair has. By the way, he was the keynote speaker at President Shimon Peres's international conference. It's a gathering of academics, military personnel, media people, and some political leaders. And he was invited by Shimon Peres to be the keynote speaker. He made a statement at that point in time that he believes there will be peace in the next year in the Middle East. Quite interestingly, I have an idea that he's going to replace Van Rompuy as the president. The very interesting connections. You remember he converted to Catholicism 4 years ago, has a connection with the Pope. He has a foundation called the Foundation of Faith, which is used for bringing resolution to world conflict through religion. And he's the Middle East peace envoy, going to bring peace to the Middle East. Sounds like a scenario that was destined for some other person to be there in the Middle East. Possibility of what he could do. I think probably the most exciting things that are happening, as far as I'm concerned, in Israel as it relates to the return of the Lord Jesus Christ would be the preparations for the next temple that would be going up. For many years, since 1991, I have been talking about the rebuilding of the temple. In 1991, I did a video called Ready to Rebuild. Tommy Ice and Randy Price were on the video with me, and I think Randy even quoted me some in the book that they wrote as well. But we documented all of the things that are happening. It's so interesting. People are so hungry to know about it. CBS purchased it for a primetime special. We've sold about 100,000 of these over the years. But it's been amazing to see how the things have even developed from that period in time. The relationship that God has allowed us to have with these people. For example, I walked into Yeshiva, place of learning for Jewish young men, and there stood Rabbi Nachman Kahana. He was the brother of the rabbi who was killed in New York City by one of the members of the 9/11 gang who took down the Twin Towers. And Nachman Kahana seated at his computer, and I said, "What are you doing there on the computer?" He said, "I'm studying the priestly duties of the book of Leviticus." And I said, "Well, do you have the computer for anything else?" He said, "I do." I said, "What?" He said, "I have a database of every male Jew that's qualified to be a priest on here." I said, "Why?" He said, "We've gathered them all into Jerusalem." I said, 28,000? I see the scriptures indicating that's how many you need. He said, "Yes," and they're studying the priestly duties. And it is very, very interesting. The problem I kept having, though, is I went over, and the two men who started the Temple Institute, if you've ever had opportunity to be there, the two men are students of Rabbi Kahana. And when I went to the Temple Institute, I noticed the temple that they were going to build was Herod's temple. They took all their information from Maimonides, the great Jewish sage out of Egypt, and they were going to build Herod's temple. But I just ran into a man, a part of now the organization at the Temple Institute, Yoel Keren. He has La Mikdash to the temple. And he said to me that there are two Jewish temples in the future, and one of them is the temple described in the book of Ezekiel. I'd never heard a Jew make that statement. Listen to what he has to say.
The idea that there will be another temple, a final temple, not the one that we're preparing to build now. And when I say the final temple, I mean temple building structure itself. When we talk about periods of the first temple, the second temple, and the third and final temple, we're talking about periods of time, not necessarily physical structures. During the second temple period, there were several physical structures there on the Temple Mount. Like I said, first there was an altar, then there was the first building that was part of the second temple structure. It was a simple wooden building. Then later a stone building was put in place, and then later Herod put in the grand temple that we know as Herod's temple, what people traditionally think of as the second temple. The same is true with the third temple. We have to build, by Jewish law, the rabbis have told us to rebuild the temple according to the plan of Herod's temple, what we had in the second temple. But we know that in the future, when the Messiah comes, we will have Ezekiel's temple, which is on a much more grandiose scale. And this is exactly what was done when the captives returned from Babylon and built the second temple. They incorporated all of the ideas that they thought they could understand or that they could physically accomplish from Ezekiel's plan. They incorporated that into the building of the second temple. What they couldn't understand or what they knew they couldn't physically accomplish, they left over for when the Messiah would come and build the final temple, the one envisioned by Ezekiel.
Now, that's an Orthodox Jew. He's a rabbi making a statement, the Messiah will come and build Ezekiel's temple. That's what Zechariah chapter 6, verses 12 and 13 says. He'll come, build the temple, and then rule and reign from that temple. Some of the other preparations that have been made, for example, King David called for 4,000 harps to be played in a harp orchestra by the Levites when the temple was in place. And a couple, Micah and Shoshana Harari, in fact, Rabbi Kahana told me about them. They had a shop at number 10 King David Street at that time, went over, but now they've moved their shop out into the country where they have more space to work. And John and I interviewed Micah and Shoshana while we were there as well.
Approximately how many of these harps have you made in the back room back here?
Well, we've been doing this since about 1984, and we've made, maybe 3,000 or 4,000.
3,000 harps.
Now we make them slower. We have less people out here in the country. So we make about 3 a month.
But your quality is fantastic.
Thank you. Well, we built our harps as if King David ordered them. Mm-hmm. If he said that, we need harps for the temple, and this is what we're doing.
Figure, do you believe that this is something that God has given you and Shoshana to do for the times in which we're living?
Yeah, these are the end days, and it says that we will return to the land at the end of days, and that everybody should bring something that was lost. So we returned harp making to the land, and as we know, the harp is a national instrument of Israel. And it's been silent for thousands of years when we went into exile and hung our harps upon the willows. But we return now, and we've built the beautiful land, and the harps of God called a harp maker to make harps, I guess, in the Holy Land. And we came and started to make them, and we're making them for the next temple. This is really our focus. And when King David shows up again, we'll give him the place. We'll just go to work for him.
Love that comment. When King David shows up again, we'll give him the place. He can take over and finish up all the harps. Well, King David will show up, and there will be Levites to play those 4,000 harps. When he made the first 10-string harp, the Jerusalem Post did an article on it, and it said it was the first harp made in 2,000 years in Jerusalem by this couple. The next day, an old rabbi in his 80s showed up, said, "Do you have a 10-string harp?" He said, "I do." He said, "May we see it?" And he said, "Yes." And the old rabbi held the harp in his arms, and he was crying. And Shoshana said, "Why are you crying, Rabbi?" He said, "Because the Talmud, of course, extra-biblical Jewish writing, the Talmud says when a 10-string harp shows up in Jerusalem, it's the time for the coming of the Messiah." and that 10-string harp is in Jerusalem, even as we sit here tonight. There's another exciting bit of information coming out. On my video, Ready to Rebuild, I had a man, a young man named Levi, who has since become a rabbi. He was working at the Temple Institute, and he showed all of the articles, the implements that they had made for the operation of the temple. But now he has moved out beyond the Temple Institute. They moved out to a settlement just a bit north of Jericho, where they are going to replicate the holy place and the altar, because these men who are studying the priestly duties have studied all the Levitical responsibilities they have, but now they have to have hands-on practical training to be able to go up onto the Temple Mount. Listen to what he had to say about that.
Why the need for a school to train the priests and the Levites at this particular point? The day is coming very close when on this hill in back of me there will be the third temple, as prophesied in the Bible. And when that day comes, the priests and the Levites must be prepared. We have to remember that for 2,000 years, the Jewish people not only have been removed from their homeland, but they've been removed spiritually as well. For 2,000 years, there's been no service in the temple itself. And when we talk about service in the temple, we're not just talking about an aspect of a level of importance as A to Z. We're talking about really everything that's connected to the Bible. Two-thirds of the Bible talk about, God has given us commandments about the work in the temple itself. And that's why it's so important. And the day now has come, finally, to prepare these priests and Levites for their particular job. Take an average priest from the street or a Levite and bring him up to the Temple Mount. What will he be able to do? What will his reaction be? How will he be able to bring the sacrificial blood and sprinkle it in its right place? How will he be able to bring the wine libation to its proper place if he's not prepared? What we are doing for the first time is opening the academy for the Levites and the priests in order to prepare them for this particular day. We're making an exact scale, one-to-one, exactly the way the temple stood. We're starting with the altar, which is the main aspect of the temple service. And the altar itself, what by itself, was a project. It reached a height of 5 meters, 32 meters across. And on it, the priests will practice exactly how to slaughter the animals, where to throw the blood, where to throw the water libation, and all the aspects of the service. So when the time comes, they will be prepared in order to start the work in the temple in Jerusalem.
They think that they are ready for that time. And they want to make sure the men know how to do the practical aspect of operating the temple. By the way, did you see the seven-branch candelabra? They believe that that when Titus went back to Rome to walk through the Arch of Titus, which his father erected for him after his victory there in Jerusalem, a monument to the fulfillment of prophecy, by the way, in the city of Rome, that they took the menorah with them. The Israeli government dispatched some personnel from the Ministry of Religious Affairs to meet with the Pope. He would not acknowledge that they had the menorah, and so they went ahead. That is 100 pounds of pure gold. I didn't say ounces. I said 100 pounds of pure gold. They made a wax model of the menorah. They made a form out of it, and then they poured the gold into that form. And that is the menorah that they're ready to put up on the Temple Mount. It's in the area of the Western Wall Plaza. Also, they have all the garments for the priest made. They have put them in boxes, given them to the 28,000 men studying the priestly duties. There's a note in the box. When the Dome of the Rock comes down, open the box, put on your priestly garment, and go to the Temple Mount. So they are ready for what's going to take place there. This is unique that they're getting the practical experience out there near Jericho. I just want to show you one more comment made by the head of the Temple Institute. His name is Yehuda Glick. Yehuda Glick was so excited when we filmed him because the Israeli government had just approved for school children to be able to visit the Temple Mount and the Temple Institute to learn their heritage. He talks about that, and then I want you to notice what happens as he's standing there. It's like, and we didn't plan this, but it's like, cue the children, and they walk into the scene. Watch and listen to what he says to them.
the conference we had this week, many representatives from different parties of the Israeli parliament participated, and many ministers from the cabinet have sent their blessings to the conference. I was very happy, pleased to hear this morning how the Minister of Education announced that any school who wants to go visit the Temple Mount, the ministry will support this. And the concept is bringing back Jerusalem to the center of Jewish thought. And therefore, we encourage students to come, and the government officially supports Jews who want to come to the Temple Mount. We're calling upon Israeli students, come and visit the Temple Mount, and the government will support all schools that want to go on the Temple Mount. But the only question is not what the ministry or the government will support. It's the children and the people who want to come. We're calling upon all those who want to come. Please come. The more and more people will come, the government will be obliged to support this project of building the temple. Shalom, yiladim. Hefo atem? Why? Ze chatichat alicha. Alachtem at lifnei kama yamim yatzatem?
He'll translate.
אבל אתם יודעים שהיה מישהו בבית אל, והוא שכב, ובלילה היה לו חלום. אתם מכירים אותו? וואי, יפה מאוד. ובאמת הוא ראה מלאכים שעולים ויורדים בסולם. והמלאכים האלה שבעצם אומרים חז"ל שזה בעצם הכהנים שעומדים בבית המקדש. ואם יש ילדים שבאים מבית אל ללמוד על בית המקדש, כל הכבוד. אתם בטוח, אתם יודעים מי הולך לבנות את בית המקדש? אתם יודעים מי הולך לבנות בית המקדש? אתם! עכשיו אתם ישמעו, מי הולך לבנות בית המקדש?
אנחנו!
לא שמעתי, מי הולך לבנות את בית המקדש?
אנחנו!
עכשיו הכי חזק שכולם ישמעו, שגם כולם ישמעו, מי הולך לבנות את בית המקדש?
אנחנו!
מה זה? זה רמקול.
Okay.
These children are here from a settlement called Beit El. As we know, Beit El is where Jacob receives a dream and he sees the angels going on the ladder up to the heaven and connecting heaven to earth. And our sages explain that connecting heaven to earth means the temple. And these children, I asked them, who do you think will be building the temple? And they said, we. And I said again, who do you think will be building the temple? And they said, we. And then the third time, who do you think will be building the temple? They said, we. And these children, I hopefully, together with everybody, because the temple building is not a personal project of somebody, it's something of all peoples, of all the human mankind.
You know, what's exciting about this to me, and we look at these things and we understand that what they're doing is preparing to build the tribulation temple. They think they're preparing to build a temple for the Messiah. But what's exciting to me about that is that tribulation temple will not be built until after the rapture of the church. And they are so close to putting that temple up. I get up every morning to do rapture practice myself. I think we are at the point. I can almost hear him coming now. But all of these things going on. It's very exciting. Starting to do rapture practice over there, your son? You need to sing a song about rapture practice, man. Write one and we'll sing it before you leave tomorrow. But indeed, these things are exciting. Focusing, I believe, on Jerusalem and the Jewish people is key to our understanding of end-time Bible prophecy. And we've had the privilege, Judy and I, for 18 years to be a part of that community and society over there. And it just gets better and better every day as we watch what's going. Keep your focus on that part of the world, and you'll be able to determine where God is in his timeline for the end times. Thank you very much.